beside him, and to the side, feeling uncomfortable, not wanting to impose on this private moment. Maurice, who had been silently mouthing his prayers, now spoke out loud, addressing Philip. "I want to be a son to you," he said. "And I want you to be a father to me." But as he finished the phrase, Maurice's body suddenly flew backward and up into the air. It was exactly like the incident at the church door, or the time he had been holding little Julia. He had simply been smashed by an invisible force. Nancy ran toward him, then remembered what the Warrens had told her. She quickly snapped a photo, then ran to her husband. He was lying semi-conscious, bleeding from the nose.
"Frenchie, Frenchie, are you all right?" she cried.
"Yeah," he said groggily. "I'm okay." But Maurice wasn't okay. That night, as Nancy sat brushing her hair in the bedroom, she heard him call out, "Nancy! Nancy!" She ran to the hallway. Gazing down its length, some 20 feet, she saw Maurice lurching back and forth, bouncing off the walls of the narrow passageway. He fell forward onto the floor and began to roll and spin, his feet striking the walls.
"Leave me alone! Leave me alone!" he cried.
His body started to flop about like a fish pulled out of the water and thrown on a dock. Terrified, Nancy sank to her knees and began to pray out loud.
"In the name of Jesus, leave us alone," she intoned. "In the name of Jesus, leave us alone. In the name of Jesus, leave us alone."
Eventually, the convulsions stopped. Maurice lay there, struggling for his breath. He told Nancy that he just wanted to rest there a while. Inside, he was afraid of another attack and felt he just couldn't handle another. He lay on that spot the whole night. A few days later, Maurice and Nancy were outside tending to the animals when they heard the crunch of tires in their gravel driveway. Nancy was brushing the dog, and Maurice was taking the cow to the barn. Nancy looked over at her husband. "You expecting anybody?" she asked. Maurice shook his head. A white sedan came up over the rise and pulled to within several yards of the house. Maurice and Nancy could see there were several men in the car. One got out on the passenger's side. He was a young, clean-cut man with aggressive, hawkish features. He walked straight up to Maurice. "I feel I've been sent here to pray or to help you in some way," he said. Nancy didn't like the looks of the young man, without being able to say why. She told him what the Warrens told her to say in case they were bothered by publicity seekers or people with obscure religious motives. "Look," she said, "we want everybody to just leave us alone. We don't want any outside help at this time. Thank you anyway. Now please leave our property." As Nancy was speaking, a second man got out of the car on the driver's side. He had a Polaroid instant camera in his hands. Before anyone could react, he had aimed it at Maurice and Nancy and started to click off a shot of the beleaguered couple. As the camera whirred and spit out a color photo, Maurice exploded into action. He grabbed the man with the camera and ripped the photo out of his hands.
"Now you get out of here!" Maurice shouted.
The men were already scrambling back into the car. The vehicle was roaring in reverse back down the driveway before the doors were even closed. Maurice couldn't help laughing a little, despite his anger. Phony faith healers were a lot easier to chase off than raccoons, he thought.
"Hey, honey, did you see them take off?"
he said, turning to his wife. Nancy didn't reply. She was looking at the photo that had fallen to the ground when Maurice had torn it from the grasp of the intruder.
"Frenchie, look at this,"
she said, crouching over it, pointing at it with the handle of the dog brush. Maurice picked up the picture. He was afraid to look at it after seeing Nancy's face. Now what, he thought. He forced his eyes to the little colored square. In the photo, Nancy's mouth was open, obviously in mid-sentence as she talked with one of the men, and Maurice could be seen advancing toward the camera.
"Yeah, so?" said Maurice.
Frenchie, look at the ground.
Maurice looked at the photo again. All around his feet, flames were leaping out of the ground. Before he would consider a formal exorcism, Bishop Harrington sent two Catholic lay healers to meet with Father Beardsley and the Ferials. Maurice and Nancy were eager to meet with anyone sent by the bishop, and anxious to show Father Beardsley and the two healers the remarkable photo. Maurice and Nancy drove to the rectory and were introduced to the two healers, whose names were Jesse Curtis and Mike Loggia. "Maurice, Bishop Harrington asked us to come and see if we could help you," said Jesse. "The truth is, we have never experienced a case like yours, as it has been described to us by the bishop and Father Beardsley. We're used to saying prayers for those who are very ill, perhaps with cancer or another life-threatening disease."
"Well, his life is being threatened," said Nancy. "Here, look at this."
She thrust the Polaroid photo into Jesse's hands. He glanced at the photo and quickly passed it to Mike, who blanched as he looked at it. He began tearing it to shreds.
"You don't want to look at that," he said, clearly frightened. "You don't even want to think about anything like that."
Although Nancy was shocked by the action, she reassured herself that these men had been sent, after all, by the bishop, and they must know what was best. "We'd like to say some prayers over Maurice now," said Jesse. "Is that okay with you, Maurice?" Maurice nodded his head warily. The two men assumed positions on either side of the farmer, and each placed a hand on his head. Mike began the first prayer. Immediately, Maurice's body stiffened completely, as if his muscles were undergoing some sort of electric shock. Mike closed his eyes and continued the prayer. Laughter boomed out of Maurice in a deep, powerful voice.
"Ha ha 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 ha!"
The two healers were so startled for an instant that their hands recoiled from Maurice's head, although each quickly replaced his hand. Blood and a substance that looked like yellow glue was now pumping out of Maurice's mouth, and Nancy ran into the rectory kitchen for a towel, which Mike used to clean Maurice's shirt front. The two healers continued to pray for about 15 minutes. When they were finished, they were anxious to declare victory and go home. Standing in the driveway as they were preparing to leave, Jesse tried to reassure Nancy. "I'm sure everything's going to be all right now," he said. But Nancy knew everything was not all right. Maurice was doing his best to continue farming, although all semblance of normality in his life had long since been stolen by the evil force that had turned his existence into one long scream for help. Sitting atop his tractor as it rumbled up and down the long rows that he would soon seed with tomato plants, Maurice thought back to the days when his feet hadn't even reached the pedals, and his cruel father had tormented him with his inadequacies. What kind of world was it, he thought, that chose some for a life of ease and education, and for others, poverty, ignorance, and torment? Speaking aloud in his native French-Canadian patois, Maurice addressed the heavens.
"Pourquoi le laissez-vous m'ennuyer comme ça?" he shouted. "Why are you letting him torment me like this?"
As Maurice returned his gaze to the earth, he saw a stranger standing in front of him. The man, dressed in normal winter clothes, wore his hair long. His gentle face bore a look of compassion. Maurice had never seen the man before, although there was something familiar about him. Nonetheless, Maurice did not like intruders on his land.
"What are you doing here?" he said, in a none-too-friendly way.
"Stop your laboring," said the man.
"What are you talking about?" Maurice replied. "I still got one more turn to do."
"Don't you think you've done enough for today?" the stranger asked. The voice was oddly familiar. Where had Maurice heard it before?
"I've got one more row to do, and I want to finish it," he told the man.
"You'll be coming into a lot of money soon, Maurice," the stranger said. "Remember what has happened to you, and help people with it. Now, stop. You've done enough for today." So many bizarre things had happened to Maurice that he didn't know what to make of this man. He might be real or illusion, he might be good or evil. Maurice felt he had no way to judge. He didn't even trust the evidence of his senses any longer. The stranger's tone was comforting, and what he said reassuring. But the Warrens had warned Maurice that evil might show itself to him in an attractive form. He decided to ignore the man. He put the tractor in gear and depressed the gas pedal, but the machine lurched crazily. Maurice put the tractor in neutral and jumped down. Both front tires were flat. He was sure that only seconds ago, both tires had been in perfect condition. Spinning around to confront the stranger, Maurice saw nothing but the empty field, freshly plowed. He felt the hair on the back of his neck stand straight up. Glancing down, Maurice noticed footprints in the newly turned earth. He followed them along the furrows for 50 feet, and then stopped abruptly. Staring down at the ground, Maurice could not believe what he saw. The footprints ended in the middle of the field. Maurice surveyed the freshly plowed and softened earth in every direction, yet there were no more footprints. It simply wasn't possible. It was as if the stranger had disappeared into thin air. And yet it couldn't have been an apparition. Here were his footprints. It wasn't possible that the man hadn't been there. But it wasn't possible that he had disappeared either. Frenchy! Frenchy! Maurice looked up to see his son Mark approaching. Hey, what was that crazy guy doing out here? Mark asked.
You saw him? Maurice asked.
Yeah, I saw him. He walked right by the house.
Why do you say he was crazy?
What would you call it? Mark asked. Walking around in March with no shoes on.
That night, Maurice dreamed of his childhood, of the time when he was 12 years old. It was snowing. It was snowing very hard. He had to get home to Mama. She would be worried about him, and his father would beat him. But it was cold and white, so white he couldn't see anything, and the snow was stinging his face. It was so cold his tears were freezing on his cheeks. Blinded and half hysterical, he fell into a snowbank and lay there sobbing as the snow soaked through his patched winter clothes. Suddenly, he felt someone pulling him up out of the snowbank. It was a man with a kindly face.
Come, Maurice. I will take you home, he said.
Maurice sat up with a start. That face! That voice! No wonder the stranger in the field had seemed so familiar. It had been more than 40 years, but Maurice had not forgotten. The man in the field was the same man who had pulled him from the snowbank when he was a little boy. Sitting there in bed, Maurice began to cry. 12. Maurice and Nancy were never alone in the house now. Either Ed and Lorraine Warren, or one of their team of observers, was with the beleaguered couple at all times. They were used to being together, and the investigators had become a part of the Theriol clan, even helping in the daily activities around the house. Monday dawned crisp and cool. It had now been 2 days since Maurice's moving encounter with the mysterious and kindly stranger in the field. The two Chrises, Finberg and McKenna, were on duty at the Theriol house. McKenna had worked on several cases with the Warrens before. Finberg, McKenna's classmate in college, had been begging his friend to go along ever since he'd first heard about his work with the famous couple. Everybody had gone to church together the day before, and for 48 blessed hours, nothing had happened. None of the terrifying phenomena that had turned the Theriol family life into a combination of horror story, scientific experiment, and tourist attraction had made a reappearance. For 2 days, Maurice had been himself, and the Theriol home had settled into the rhythm of farm life. It was now planting season, and there was plenty of activity on the farm. Ed Warren called several times a day, and during that Monday morning's call, Chris McKenna told his teacher
that he thought the siege might be over. The appearance of the stranger in the field might have been a sign to Maurice that it stopped, the young man theorized. He had a degree in psychology, and thought that if Maurice had taken the apparition in the field as some sort of benediction or deliverance, his troubles might be finished.
No, it's not over, replied Ed. These kinds of preternatural events don't just stop like that. I'd love to think you're right, and for Maurice's sake, I hope you are. But from everything I've seen, whatever is possessing Maurice will have to be driven out. It won't just leave.
It took only 2 hours for Ed to be proved correct. After coffee and croissants and pitching in to wash the morning dishes, the two observers split up. Chris Finberg stayed in the farmhouse to help Nancy with the laundry. Chris McKenna went to the greenhouse with Maurice to help him plant tomato seedlings. McKenna liked working with Finberg. For one thing, McKenna had helped train his friend as an observer. For another, Finberg was a good photographer, and that was always useful. Every passing day was bringing the farmer closer to planting the now sturdy tomato shoots. Maurice was eager to turn out a good crop. He knew that to most people, the biblical injunction, "As ye sow, so shall ye reap," meant that they shouldn't cause discord or bad actions that would rebound on them. But he also believed it literally, and he knew that a good harvest would depend on, among other things, strong seedlings, well planted in the earth. He always loved this time of year. The new moon was approaching, the best time for planting. Maurice spent much of the morning showing his young assistant how to care for the young shoots that would later that year bear the ripe red fruit that drew people from miles around to Frenchie's vegetable stand. Frenchie poked a short finger into one of the damp egg cartons that bore tiny shoots. The greenhouse was a forest of fine green baby plants, neatly planted in endless rows of cartons. Each plant had 2 or 3 leaves on its fuzzy stalk. You got to give 'em just enough water and just enough sun so they'll be strong enough to plant, the farmer explained. Too much of either and they'll die. McKenna was less interested in the fine art of tomato growing than he was in the extraordinary paranormal events that surrounded Maurice. Still, he thought to himself, it's always interesting to listen to an expert talk about what he knows best. So many of the students who studied with the Warrens began by imagining that they would be rummaging through romantic castles in the English countryside, pursuing famous ghosts. They soon learned, however, that manifestations of evil can take place anywhere and are just as likely to appear in a 2-story suburban colonial home as in the dungeon of a deserted chateau. Or, for that matter, in the simple lifestyle of a Massachusetts farmer. Some castle, thought McKenna, looking around the plastic and plexiglass greenhouse and smiling to himself. Despite the lingering winter weather, it was hot inside the greenhouse, and Maurice had stripped down to a t-shirt. Chris decided that was a good idea and did the same. When he was comfortable, he began watering the cardboard boxes of seedlings as Maurice had shown him. It was hard work. There were thousands of the tiny plants, and the process of filling the watering can, bending over each plant, trying to give it just enough water, and then after watering 15 or 20 plants, refilling the can and starting all over again, was maddening. Chris was on his 3rd refill when he was startled by a strange, menacing voice behind him.
You put goddamn ice cubes down my back, the voice growled.
McKenna whirled around to find Maurice, his face contorted in an angry scowl, standing right behind him. He was breathing right into his face, and Chris was sickened by the smell of his breath.
Maurice! You scared the heck out of me! He exclaimed, keeping his cool. Nobody put anything down your back.
Maurice said nothing, but glowered at the young man. Then slowly he turned away from Chris. McKenna's eyes widened. The back of the farmer's t-shirt was laced with bright crimson lines, some in the form of a cross, others spelling out words McKenna could not understand. McKenna quickly grabbed Maurice by the arm. Okay, Maurice, he said. Let's go up to the house. he began tugging the muscular little man out of the greenhouse. Everybody needs to see this. Climbing the steep gravel slope up to the farmhouse, McKenna called out to Chris Finberg and Nancy, both of whom came running to the kitchen door when they heard Chris's noticeably urgent tone of voice. McKenna pulled Maurice into the house. Nancy, get a wet towel and another shirt for Maurice, he instructed. She already knew what to do and hurried off to get the supplies. Then Chris Finberg began to quiz his partner. What happened down there?
I don't know, McKenna replied.
One minute we were watering the tomatoes, the next minute he was accusing me of putting ice cubes down his back. Then I saw this. He gestured at Maurice's scarlet-streaked T-shirt.
Let's get his shirt off and see what's written there, Finberg suggested, still staring at the bloody garment.
McKenna nodded agreement.
Maurice, raise your arms, he said.
Maurice didn't struggle, but he wasn't making it easy for them to remove his shirt either. The two men peeled the farmer's shirt up over his head and stood rooted to the spot, staring dumbfounded at his back. There wasn't a mark on it.
My God, look at that,
Finberg exclaimed.
How the hell did he do that? Let me see that T-shirt.
McKenna held it up. It was snow white. No stains, no lines, not a trace of red. Nothing. The two men looked at each other without a word as Maurice stood shivering between them. Chris Finberg finally broke the silence.
Ed was right, he said.
Ed and Lorraine arrived late that night. The two Chrises needed some time off and were both shaken up by what they had seen that day. And Nancy was especially relieved to have the Warrens there now. She really wondered if soon might not be too late for Maurice.
You guys go on home and rest, Ed advised Chris and Chris. Sonny is coming in the morning, and we'll call you right away if we need you.
Sitting around the Theriol table that night, it was clear to Ed and Lorraine that an alien presence was not happy that they were in the house. Throughout the evening, the conversation was interrupted by the sound of car doors slamming right outside. But each time Ed went to see what was causing the noise, he could find no vehicle or any other cause. And intermittently, the lights in the house would dim, then return to their original brightness, then dim again. After dinner, Nancy swung open the door to the dining room, excitedly calling Ed to the kitchen.
Look,
she said, pointing toward the ceiling. Balanced on top of a curtain rod above the kitchen window was a tray with four small cups on it.
What happened? Ed asked.
I don't know, said Nancy. I was looking for that tray so I could serve some cherry pie. I couldn't find it anywhere. Then I walked in here and looked up, and there it was.
Of course, Ed thought, it could have been put there as a prank by anyone in the house, but he doubted it. No one was treating the frightening events of the past month as a joke. Ed and Lorraine were ever more deeply involved in the delicate negotiations with the church that might produce an exorcism for Maurice. There was no question in Ed's mind that exorcism was the only answer. But who would perform the rite? The Warrens had some ideas, but the final decision rested with the Diocese of Worcester. One problem was that the church, historically, has been slow to approve exorcisms. Another problem was that there just weren't that many experienced exorcists around anymore. The Warrens were keeping several priests informed of the daily developments inside the Theriol home. Sometimes the clergy offered advice, and they always offered prayers. The Warrens welcomed both. But they knew what was really needed was the direct intercession of a priest who was not afraid to do battle with the demon that was afflicting Maurice. Ed knew of one such priest. His name was Bishop Robert McKenna. He also lived in Monroe, just a mile or so from Ed and Lorraine's house. But Bishop Harrington would have none of it. McKenna was too controversial. Although ordained as a Roman Catholic priest, McKenna had been expelled from the church because he continued to say Mass in Latin. He operated his own chapel in Monroe with no help from Rome. In the eyes of Bishop Harrington, he would never do. The negotiations with Bishop Harrington continued. It was a sticky political situation, and Maurice's case was in limbo because of it. The day after the cups appeared on the curtain rod, Ed and Lorraine returned home, and Sonny Berryhill came up from New Britain, Connecticut. It was his shift of duty. A student at Central Connecticut State College, Berryhill was trying to study for midterm exams at the same time he was working on the Theriol case for the Warrens. He sat comfortably spread out on the sofa with his Polaroid camera, tape recorder, and a pile of textbooks. Berryhill knew from experience that he might need to record any unusual happenings and always kept the camera and recorder within reach. In the meantime, he bent his head over an anatomy book and tried to study. If anatomy were as exciting as life in the Theriol farmhouse, he thought, he'd ace every exam. Berryhill's thoughts were interrupted by Maurice's heavy step at the front door as the farmer came in from his work to have lunch.
"What you reading?" Maurice asked.
"Anatomy," the young man replied. "I'm supposed to know how the muscles work, where strength comes from, and so on."
"Strength comes from the spirits," said Maurice with a wink.
"What do you mean?"
"Come on, I'll show you."
Maurice marched down the hall and out the front door. Berryhill was about to follow when he remembered his camera.
"I'll be right there,"
he called, and ran back to the living room. He hurriedly attached the flash cube while running back. When he got to the front door, he stopped dead in his tracks. Looking out, he could see Maurice in front of the house, and what he saw was hard to believe. Several times, coming up the driveway, Berryhill had noticed a life-size statue of a saint, although Sonny couldn't say which saint, leaning propped against the house. Solid cement, enough to withstand the winter and the high winds that blew across the exposed hill, it must have weighed hundreds of pounds, in Berryhill's estimation. What had stopped Berryhill in his tracks was the sight of Maurice, his two hands delicately wrapped around the base, holding the statue in the air. What was even more shocking was the expression on his face. Maurice showed no sign of exertion at all. The Warren's observer quickly snapped off a photo and placed the camera on the kitchen counter, then ran out to join Maurice, who was just replacing the statue. The farmer straightened with a little smile on his face. He wasn't sweaty, or even breathing hard. Without a word, Berryhill, whose weightlifting had left him capable of bench-pressing 150 pounds, grabbed the statue and heaved with all his might. It didn't budge. "How'd you do that, Maurice?" he asked, after giving up on his own efforts.
"I just call on the spirits," the farmer said, looking upward and chuckling. "I'd done that all my life, ever since I had to lift heavy logs and sacks for my father when I was a kid."
2 weeks had passed since Bishop Harrington's spontaneous effort to rid Maurice of his torment, and Ed Warren hadn't yet been able to arrange for a formal exorcism. Finally, the bishop and the Warrens agreed on a man, Father Neil Delaney. Although not an exorcist per se, Father Delaney, a faith healer, was no stranger to the power of prayer, since he held regular healing services at his church in nearby Auburn. He was a Roman Catholic in good standing, well known to Bishop Harrington, and a friend of the Warrens as well. The Warrens had met him under unusual circumstances 7 years earlier, during a legendary storm referred to throughout Massachusetts as the Blizzard of 78. They had been on a speaking tour of New England and were on a stop at Keene State College in New Hampshire when they saw a feature on the television news about Father Delaney, a Catholic priest who performed faith healing. That got their attention because they had not known many Catholics who believed in the practice. It was usually more the province of fundamentalist Christians. A few days later, the Warrens arrived in Worcester for a talk at Worcester State College. But along came the blizzard of 78. It snowed for days. People were stranded everywhere. Drifts of 6 feet were the rule. Travel was absolutely impossible. The state of Massachusetts, in effect, had shut down. Ed and Lorraine sat in their room in the Holiday Inn in Auburn, waiting for the roads to be cleared so they could return home to Connecticut. As they sat on their bed reading, Lorraine turned to Ed.
Honey, remember the report we saw on the news the other day about that Catholic faith healer?
Ed peered up from his book. Yeah?
Well, I just remembered that he lives in Auburn.
So?
Well, why don't we give him a call?
We?
Okay, I'll do it.
Lorraine pulled the phone directory out of the nightstand and looked up Father Delaney's name.
Here it is, she exclaimed.
Ed looked up from his book again. And just what do you have in mind?
I don't know. Maybe we can get together for a chat. He seems like such an interesting man.
Ed chuckled. Oh, and how do you plan on doing that? The whole city is paralyzed.
We'll find a way,
Lorraine replied, dialing the phone number. And so began their friendship. Father Delaney invited the Warrens over to the rectory for a private healing service, and it turned out they needed it, for by the time they had walked a mile through the snow, Ed and Lorraine were exhausted. But it was an afternoon to remember. Lorraine came away a firm believer in the healing power of prayer and the laying on of hands. So when Bishop Harrington suggested Father Delaney for Maurice's exorcism, she and Ed approved wholeheartedly. Father Delaney agreed to try it, but he refused to call it an exorcism. He preferred to try what he called a deliverance. Ed raised an eyebrow when he heard that, but figured that if Father Delaney was comfortable calling it a deliverance, it couldn't hurt. The deliverance turned out to be almost an exact replay of the healing prayers performed over Maurice. Done in the presence of Father Beardsley at the rectory of St. Paul's, the result was virtually identical. As soon as the prayers began, Maurice stiffened. Soon, blood and a yellow substance began to seep out of his mouth. Despite questioning by Father Delaney, no sound came from Maurice during the service. Afterward, Maurice seemed exhausted and depressed.
I don't know how much longer he can go on, Nancy reported to the Warrens.
She could have been speaking for herself as well. She, too, was feeling completely worn out and down. Maybe Maurice's case was hopeless. Still, the Ferrials continued to visit with Father Delaney, often having Sunday dinner with the priest, then attending his prayer services afterward. But the mayhem continued in the Ferrial house. Chris Finberg's notes reveal the atmosphere inside, where a small circle of people were sharing an ordeal that none could explain and that none would ever forget. Fire in the greenhouse. Seems to be a car coming. Sonny and Rick went outside to investigate. Could not see or hear anything. Just prior to Sonny and Rick's coming back inside, it happened again. Chris called from the bedroom, stated that he was very dizzy in one corner of the room. Everyone is becoming weak and lightheaded. Benjamin Massey and Jessica Spellman were on duty as observers. Jessica, more than a little frightened by what she had seen and heard about the Ferrial case, asked her boyfriend, Chad, to come to the Ferrial farmhouse as well. They were joined over the weekend by several more of the observing team. Nancy had gone to bed early, but Maurice was still awake. He and several observers, bound together by the extraordinary events of the past 2 weeks, sat in the Ferrials' cramped living room and tried to speak of inconsequential matters, of school and farming and gossip about friends. The two young men spent some time dissecting the recent upset victory of the Villanova basketball team over heavily favored Georgetown to win the NCAA championship. Jessica was telling Maurice why the recent announcement by the White House that President Reagan would visit the war cemetery in Bitburg, West Germany, was making so many people angry. Inevitably, however, the conversation turned to the Warrens and their work with preternatural phenomena. They were, at this very moment, back in Tewksbury, where the haunted house of Marie Wyatt was proving more and more troublesome. By this time, the poor family had been driven from their home by the unending barrage of unexplained knockings, moanings, and flying objects. Much as they wanted to help both families, the Warrens were determined to see Maurice through his ordeal before they took on another full-time case. Still, they had visited the Tewksbury home, and coming as it did on the heels of all the publicity about Maurice, the media were in hot pursuit. But none of this conversation seemed to be holding Maurice's attention. The frustration of waiting was making him irritable, and as Benjamin, Jessica, and the others chatted away, Maurice began to pace the room like a captured beast whose cage is too small. Back and forth he stalked, his movements becoming more and more agitated.
"I'm telling you," Benjamin was saying, now back on college basketball again. "Thompson isn't that great a coach. It was Ewing who—"
Crash! The noise made everyone jump and brought the conversation to a sudden halt in mid-sentence. It sounded as if somebody had thrown a rock into the living room.
"What the hell was that?" someone shouted.
Jessica wore an amazed expression.
Look,
she stuttered, pointing at the coffee table. Where a glass ashtray had rested only moments ago, there was now a pile of cinders and broken glass. The ashtray had literally exploded. The three young people looked at Maurice, who had stopped pacing. His eyes seemed to have gone opaque, and it was as if he were no longer in the room. A deep moan came welling out of his chest. Jessica's boyfriend, Chad, grabbed her hand.
"Come on," he said, almost shouting. "We're getting out of here."
Chad wound up doing exactly that, but Jessica wasn't about to leave. She had always been fascinated by psychic phenomena, and working with the Warrens had left her, if not fearless, at least more familiar with the kinds of events involved in a case of possession. Jessica was 35 years old. Her 135 pounds were well distributed on her tall frame, and the dark-haired, brown-eyed observer had been drawing admiring glances from some of the males in the group, even though most were much younger. Several times during her own life, she'd had experiences that were, she found out, extremely unusual. Starting when she was 13 years old, she would often have dreams foretelling events that would then take place, often exactly as they had in the dream. Wanting to learn more about such occurrences, she enrolled in the Warrens course and began to discover that her gift, while unusual, did not mean she was crazy. In fact, it was a gift shared by Lorraine Warren. The Warrens were delighted that Massey had agreed to assist in this case. A 27-year-old handyman, Massey had taken a course with the Warrens at a local high school and had responded eagerly to their request for volunteer observers. Lorraine told the young man that she had been watching him throughout the lecture. "You have the brightest aura in the class," she said. Massey was a meticulous note-taker and brought his own recording equipment to the Ferryall home. He switched on the machine whenever an unusual sound or event took place. Neither he nor Jessica could sleep very much. Jessica was telling Benjamin about an incident that had taken place earlier that afternoon. One of the observers had brought a friend along. After several minutes' conversation with the newcomer, it was clear to Jessica that he had come neither to study or learn, nor to help Maurice. He was at the Ferryall home for a thrill, hoping something spectacular of a supernatural nature would take place. Nothing occurred for several hours, and the young man, whom Jessica had already dubbed the skeptic, lectured the others about all the possible scientific explanations for each of the events they had witnessed. After touring the house and meeting Maurice and Nancy, the visitor became impatient. Jessica was never sure afterward if he did it to show off for her, but the young man announced that he wasn't waiting any more for these spirits. "Watch this," he said. Walking into Maurice and Nancy's bedroom, he hastily scribbled a note and dropped it onto their bed. Jessica picked it up. She turned pale.
"You don't want to do this," she said.
"Yes, I do," the young man replied.
The note read, "Spirits, if you are in this house, show yourselves to me." It was, as Chris McKenna was to remark later, a foolhardy and dangerous game. Ed Warren had taught all the students that challenging a demonic force, or any phenomenon beyond their understanding, was the worst thing they could do in these cases. 10 minutes later, the reason for Ed's warnings became clear, although it was almost as humorous to the people in the house as it was frightening. The arrogant newcomer was busy giving the others a lecture about not being afraid of hocus-pocus when his belt buckle suddenly popped open. He stopped in mid-sentence and gazed down with a stupefied look on his face. He was still in that position when his zipper broke and his pants began to sag down around his thighs. Jessica didn't know whether to laugh or cry as the young man grabbed his waistband and fled the house. Hearing the story, Benjamin Massey did laugh. "Some people really are crazy," he said. It was then that the sounds started. Benjamin hastily switched on his tape recorder. Directly under the couch on which Jessica was lying came scratching sounds, as if hundreds of rats were scrambling all over the floor. Peering under the couch, Benjamin saw nothing. A quick check of the basement revealed it to be empty. Just as suddenly as the noises had begun, they ceased. The pair looked in every room, but could find no cause for the mysterious scratching sounds. Coming back to the living room, Jessica was surprised to hear the television blaring. It hadn't been on when they had left the room. She switched it off. Benjamin and Jessica resumed their places on the couch and chair and tried to talk. The silence was frightening. Even for people with their training and experience, each knew that the period between 9 p.m. and 4 a.m. is what investigators of the paranormal call the psychic hours, when preternatural events are much more likely to occur. Shortly after 1 a.m., the observers heard several car doors slam in the Theriol driveway, only yards from where they were seated. They ran to the window, but despite a well-lit driveway, they could see no vehicles. Stepping outside, they confirmed that the driveway was empty. Just then, Jessica heard what sounded like a police dispatcher's radio squawking in the hall. The couple raced back inside, but the hallway, too, was mockingly empty. "Whatever it is we're hearing, it doesn't seem to want to show itself," said Benjamin. "I vote we try to get some sleep." Despite the excitement, they managed to fall asleep eventually. Benjamin was in a deep, dreamless slumber when he was catapulted out of his chair by Jessica's screams. Bolt upright on the couch, she stared with horror at a plaster statue of an Indian that stood next to the Theriol's television.
"What is it, Jessica?"
"He told me to get out of the house."
"Who told you?"
"The Indian."
"The statue talked?"
"And he hurt me. He hurt my legs."
"How'd he do that?" Benjamin asked.
"I don't know," Jessica replied. "All I know is my legs ache now and they didn't before."
"Shit," said Benjamin. "I think I'd better just stay up with you the rest of the night." In the morning, Maurice's 4-year-old granddaughter, Sadie, came with her mother to visit. While the adults chatted in the kitchen, Benjamin Massey did his best to amuse the child. "You want to draw?" he asked. Sadie nodded solemnly. Benjamin went off to the kitchen and returned in a moment with paper and crayons. Benjamin sat on the floor with the youngster. "What should we draw?" he said. Sadie seemed to reflect for a moment, almost as if she were deciding whether Benjamin could be trusted. Finally, she seemed to have made up her mind.
"Let's draw the monster," she said.
"What monster?" Benjamin smiled.
"The one in the house," the little girl replied.
Benjamin's smile vanished. Without waiting for further encouragement, Sadie began to draw what she called the geese monster that she said she saw often when she visited Poppy Maurice. When the drawing was done, it didn't look like much to Benjamin. Maybe a child's idea of a ghost with a halo around its head. "Did you see the monster?" he asked the girl.
"Yeah."
"Where?"
"Lots of places."
"Can you show me where he hides?"
"Yeah."
Benjamin took the child's hand. "Show me," he said. Sadie led him into Maurice and Nancy's bedroom and pointed at the bed. "He hides in here?" The child nodded. "Where else?" Sadie covered her mouth and giggled. "Show me," said Benjamin. Sadie led him by the hand to the toilet and pointed to the toilet bowl. It's just a kid's game, Benjamin thought. A variation of Boogeyman and Pee-Pee Ka-Ka. Sadie must have seen the look on his face. Tugging his hand, she led him to the cellar steps and pointed. "He hides in the basement," Benjamin said.
"Yeah, he lives down there."
Benjamin switched on the lights inside the stairwell, picked the child up, and carried her down the steep two-tiered steps into the basement. Looking around, he could see nothing except piles of boards, a couple sacks of potatoes, and shelves containing boxes and wooden stakes used to grow the tomato seedlings. "There's nothing down here, honey," he said. But just then, Sadie pointed at the farthest corner of the cellar and began to scream. Benjamin swiveled around, but couldn't see anything frightening. Sadie, still screaming, bolted from his side and scrambled up the stairs on her hands and knees. She was halfway up before Benjamin thought to go after her. The next day, the Theriall's son-in-law, Dennis, married to Nancy's daughter, Jenny, came to visit. He didn't do that often. Too many strange occurrences took place around Maurice, and Dennis didn't mind admitting that he was terrified of the farmer and his bizarre behavior. But he couldn't very well keep his wife from visiting her mother, and as long as that was the case, he felt better if he went with her. Given the wild nature of the tales Nancy had been recounting to Jenny over the phone, Dennis's fear of what might happen to his wife if she went to the farmhouse alone was only slightly worse than his idea of what might happen to him if he went with her. But it seemed to him, as he sat rocking on the farmhouse porch, that his fears had been exaggerated. The family meal together had been without incident, and everyone was enjoying a sense of closeness that had been too often missing of late. Content with the enormous meal of fresh farm food tucked safely inside him, Dennis took a deep breath. He was imagining a moment very soon when he could go into the kitchen and say, "Honey, don't you think we ought to be hitting the road?" Pulling his down jacket more securely around him against the chilly April afternoon, Dennis continued rocking and idly watched Maurice working to separate a huge tractor tire from the metal rim of its wheel. He marveled again at the muscles on his father-in-law. "He's just a little guy," Dennis thought, "but I'll bet he could take me." Just then, the young man heard the swinging door to the kitchen slam shut. Glancing up casually over his left shoulder, Dennis almost fell over backward with fright. He leapt to his feet as Maurice brushed by him. Swiveling about, Dennis watched, dumbfounded, as the second Maurice walked up to the first one, who was still changing the tire, and seemed to walk into his body. The two Maurices had become one. That was plenty for Dennis. Like Jessica's boyfriend, Chad, he wanted out of the house, and now. Within 3 minutes, he had Jenny in their pickup and could be seen raising a cloud of dust as he got away from Maurice Theriall as fast as his truck would carry him. Jenny cast him a stricken look, but Dennis was in no mood for a reproach about their sudden rude departure. "We'll go back there when he gets his exorcism or whatever the hell else it takes," he said, "because I ain't letting you go back there again. Not while he's like that." Benjamin Massey got a phone call from Ed Warren 2 days later. He had sent Ed the cassette tapes from the weekend he and the others had spent at the house. Ed wanted to use them to help convince the church authorities of the seriousness of Maurice's plight.
"I thought you said there were all kinds of strange noises that you heard that weekend," Ed said.
"Yeah, that's right," said Benjamin. "Sounds like rats scratching and car doors slamming and the television and radio. All kinds of stuff."
"Well, there's nothing on these tapes besides people having normal conversations," Ed told him.
"Nothing?"
"Nothing."
That night, The wind howled as in an old-time Hollywood movie. Outside the Ferryall home, the animals seemed agitated, the dogs barking continuously as soon as darkness fell. Ever since the publicity about Maurice's ordeal, the couple had been plagued by anonymous phone calls and visits from jeering curiosity seekers who would drive by and shout epithets at all hours. But that didn't seem to be the case that night. Each time the dogs began barking, Maurice or Nancy would go out to investigate, only to return moments later with a quizzical expression and shrug. Despite his fears of an intruder, or perhaps a New England fox, Maurice could find no sign of trespassers, human or animal.
"I don't know what's got him going like that," he told his wife.
An hour later, with the dogs still barking, the couple decided to go to bed. It would be difficult to sleep. Between the dogs howling and the shrieking wind, Nancy saw that Maurice was becoming more and more nervous. She knew she had to do something.
"Frenchie," she said softly in the dark.
"Yeah?"
"How'd you like to learn the Hail Mary in English, and then we could say it together?"
"Okay," came the reply.
To Nancy's practiced ear, her husband sounded depressed and listless. She said a silent prayer that an exorcism would be granted soon, then embarked on the task of teaching Maurice the Hail Mary in English. Saying it out loud would reassure her as much as it would Maurice. She began,
"Hail Mary, full of grace."
"Hail Mary, full of grace," Maurice repeated.
"The Lord is with thee."
"The Lord is with thee."
Nancy continued the prayer to the end, with Maurice repeating after her, then began again. She was on her seventh repetition of the holy words.
"Hail Mary, full of..."
Nancy sat up straight, her words and breath cut off by a strong hand that was clamped around her throat like an iron fist.
"Ugh, ugh,"
she gasped as she struggled to find the chain on her bedside table lamp, finally finding it and giving it a quick jerk. The room flooded with light, and through the red cloud that was forming in front of her eyes, Nancy could see Maurice also sitting up, wearing a strange grin on his face, but with both hands folded in his lap. Maurice faded from her sight as black spots took his place. Her last thought before she lost consciousness was, too late for the exorcism. But as suddenly as it had come, the mysterious hand around her throat let go, and Nancy dragged air gratefully into her rasping lungs. Running to the bathroom, she retched for several minutes. After cleaning her face with a towel, Nancy looked at her face in the mirror over the sink. There were livid finger marks around her throat. She looked back in the bedroom. Maurice, now lying down, was sleeping soundly. It hadn't been he who had tried to strangle her.
"Now," she said to herself, sobbing. "It has to be now. We can't wait any longer, or we'll all be dead."
Ed and Lorraine Warren had come to the same conclusion. It was clear that Father Delaney's deliverance had been about as effective as Bishop Harrington's impromptu exorcism. He knew now that he needed an experienced exorcist. Ed informed Bishop Harrington that he was going to ask Bishop McKenna to do it. He knew that Bishop Harrington could never assign an expelled priest, and he was surprised that Bishop Harrington didn't try to talk him out of it. But he also knew that Harrington didn't have any alternatives. Ed called Bishop Robert McKenna that same night. McKenna was aware of the Ferryall case, of course, and had been praying for Maurice for some time, but until then, he had not been asked to intervene directly. Ed said he needed to talk with the bishop, but wanted to do it in person. McKenna, whose Our Lady of the Rosary Chapel was only a mile or so away from the Warrens' home, invited Ed and Lorraine over for coffee the next morning. But the wise bishop knew instinctively what Ed was going to ask him to do. Lying in his bed that night, McKenna could feel the approach of an enemy as old as man. Tenderly holding the rosary beads around his neck, he began to pray silently. He was asking for strength in the ordeal that he now knew was at hand. 13. Bishop Robert McKenna of Our Lady of the Rosary Chapel in Monroe woke early. He had a lot on his mind. The 58-year-old priest had exorcised evil spirits from houses before, but had never performed an exorcism on a person. A sense of foreboding gripped him. The bishop's approaching confrontation with the dark force that held Maurice Theriault in thrall did not, on the surface, look like a fair fight. McKenna was a frail wisp of a man, standing 5 feet 8 inches tall, but weighing only 130 pounds. His graying brown hair was thinned out. Behind his thick, dark glasses, fatigue, as well as wisdom, were etched in his eyes. Contributing to his frail appearance was the fact that McKenna had been fasting for days in preparation for the confrontation. It should have made him feel weak, but he didn't feel weak at all. He had prayed long and hard during his fast, and he felt strong. Fasting made him feel mentally, physically, and spiritually prepared. An air of isolation and holiness seemed to radiate from the priest. McKenna was not one to back down from a fight. He hadn't backed down when Rome ordered priests to change many of the holy rituals the church had always observed. In the 1960s, after Vatican II, the language in which the sacraments was delivered, Mass among them, was required to be the vernacular. McKenna believed it was wrong to change the way things had always been done, and he, like a small cadre of other priests around the world, refused to go along. For them, Latin always was and still is the proper language for the Holy Mass. They simply would not accede to the order to change. As a result, McKenna's order, the Dominican Order of Preachers, was no longer recognized by the Vatican. Convinced he was following the path God had ordained, McKenna continued to chant the musical magic of the Mass in Latin. For him and for his congregation, the ancient words had never seemed so precious, so full of meaning. When Rome declared it would no longer fund their church, McKenna's parishioners paid the bills themselves. Their Mass and their bishop were certainly worth the sacrifice. To them, Bishop McKenna was a hero in a time when there were too few heroes. He was following Jesus, not Rome. That took courage. But the frail prelate had no illusions. He knew that he'd need more than courage to meet Satan head-on. Earlier that morning, at dawn, there had been a spring shower. It had looked as if it was going to be a gray, gloomy day, but now the sun was shining and reflecting dazzling morning light on the dozens of wet dogwood petals that the rain had pelted to the ground. Bishop McKenna hoped the sun would continue shining for the rest of the day. Walking to the chapel that morning, he concentrated his thoughts toward God in heaven.